call the president. President, we need the National Guard. We need as many men as you can spare, because we are killing the Patriots. So call the dogs off. Send the National Guard, please. They need emergency help.
That ball hit hard. Stretch. Austin Jackson back looks up. You can put it on the board. Yes. Back to back, Jack. And it is 4-1.
Hold on, ball. Jackson has it. The All-American tight end is going in. And Oklahoma takes the lead on a 71-yard touchdown play.
I was going to rip his heart out. I'm the best ever. I'm the most brutal and vicious and most ruthless champion there's ever been. There's no one can stop me. Lex is a conqueror. No, I'm Alexander. He's no Alexander. I'm the best ever. There's never been anybody ruthless. I'm Sonny Liston. I'm Jack Dempsey. There's no one like me. I'm there.
Yo. And welcome back to the Fix Sports Podcast, the realest and blackest sports podcast you have ever heard in your entire life, coming straight from the South. Going down, I am your host, Joseph Ward, here to give you your weekly sports fix from a black perspective. Audio shop talk like you've never heard it before. We just not in the shop. We just talking like we in the shop. So if you want to grab out your clippers and put a towel around somebody's neck and put them in the bar stool and make it feel like you in a barbershop and go ahead and do what you do, just make sure you line them up straight so their edge won't be looking like mine's and LeBron's, right? So that's how we get down. Housekeeping. The Fix Sports Podcast is brought to you by On the Shoulders of Giants, and On the Shoulders of Giants brings you African history at your fingertips and on the go through their African history book series, their blog series, the YouTube channel, the African history curriculum app, the On the Shoulders of Giants nonprofit organization, as well as the classes, lectures, keynote speaking engagements, all type of public speaking series engagements, whatever you need. On the Shoulders of Giants will come to your grandmama's house at your family reunion and teach some African history, right? They will come to your backyard, to that room that got that window in the backyard, and teach about African history. So make sure you go visit www.ontheshouldersone.com to learn more about the On the Shoulders of Giants, to see the blog and get the books, as well as www.ontheshoulders.org to learn more about the On the Shoulders of Giants nonprofit organization. So let's go ahead and get into it. Before we get into it, hold up. Got to give my rundown real quick. So, of course, you know I start off with my HBCU spotlight, and today I'm putting my HBCU spotlight on my home dog, Avery Johnson. Because he led, and I should have did this a while ago, but Avery Johnson led his team to the NCAA tournament. So let me get back to that. He went to Southern, all right? So give you the results of the NCAA men's and women's tournament finals, see who won, see who balled out, who didn't ball out. Going to bring on my man, Pat Irvin, who's my boxing expert, as we break down Anthony Joshua versus Joseph Parker, and also talk about the upcoming fight that's going to happen between Anthony Joshua and Deontay Wilder. I'm also tell you about Kyrie Irving and his new knee injury, which will put him out 4 to 5 months, what that means for the Boston Celtics. Tell you about the beef going on with LeBron James and Nick Saban over shop talk, over going into the barbershop and talking about sports and life and recording it. So Nick Saban and LeBron got beef. Tell you about the Las Vegas expansion NHL team, the hockey team, who's made the playoffs in their very, very, very first year. So get into that. Give y'all a little black history. Talk about the history of the black horse jockey and how they dominated the first 3 decades of the Kentucky Derby, right? Give you a draft preview. We're going to break down the Browns and the Giants. Also give you a little information about what Jim Moore said about Josh Rosen and how I feel about that. Joe Paterno got a movie coming out. So that's my pre-rant warm-up, the Joe Paterno movie. And then in my weekly rant, half of my weekly rant don't got nothing to do with sports, but I got to give Gary Owens and his goddamn wife the business because they fucking up. And then Conor McGregor, you know you got to get it. You know you got to get it. So jump straight to my HBCU spotlight. Like I said, we are putting our HBCU spotlight on Avery Jones on. And what's up with Avery? If y'all don't know who Avery Johnson is, Avery Johnson was the point guard for the San Antonio Spurs for a good while. I think he retired, let's say 2000, maybe two at the latest, 2002, maybe 2004. But he was with the Spurs when they won their two championships. He was the point guard of the team. He said the admiral. He don't say admiral. He called David Johnson David Robinson the admiral. But the reason why he's in our HBCU spotlight because he's coaching now. He coaches the University of Alabama's basketball team. And, you know, I was talking about Colin Sexton, their freshman point guard all year. But he led the Alabama Crimson Tide team to the NCAA tournament. And, yeah, they were ousted. They were beat by Villanova, I believe. They were beat. But the fact that Avery Johnson, representing Southern University from 86 to 88, went to the NBA, had his illustrious NBA career, come out with two rings, and then go into coaching and be a successful NBA coach. So that's just letting you know that just because you come from an HBCU don't mean you can't shine. Like Rihanna said, you better shine bright like a diamond. Hey, man, I'm an HBCU grad, HBCU alumni, and I come from FAMU. So because I come from FAMU, we already know that when you come from FAMU, you could be anything. You're going to be live at what you're being in life anyway, because that's just what FAMU do. That's just the FAMU way. But we're here to let you know that any place you come from in life, but especially if you come from an HBCU, okay, what HBCU you come from, you shine bright like a Mickey Ficket diamond. So to Avery Johnson, my home dog, and I love how he say admiral, because you know the admiral, David Johnson. David Robinson, because I'm Avery Johnson, and he's David Robinson, and he is the admiral. So to Avery Johnson, to all of his accomplishments as a basketballer, and I do look to see him being inducted into one of these future basketball Hall of Fame. So my man in a little shirt, my audience, get up off y'all seats, get on your feet and clap it up for Avery Johnson. Avery Johnson, admiral. Yeah, coming down our HBCU spotlight, going straight at Avery Johnson for all the balling and just being live in life and leading the Alabama Crimson Tide to the 2018 NCAA tournament. And another thing I like about Avery Johnson is a good dude too. So Avery Johnson going to make sure that his players are together. They got their stuff together, and they turn out to be pretty good men. So one time for Avery Johnson and doing what he do. So now, we want to get into some boxing. So I want to bring my home dog, Mr. Patrick Irvin. And remember, Patrick Irvin is my co-host for the Freedom Train podcast series. And he's also the host of Lessons from the Screen. And remember, the Freedom Train podcast series comes out every Wednesday on freedomtrainradio.com. And Lessons from the Screen comes out every Thursday on freedomtrainradio.com. Also available on iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. So, Patrick, you there?
Yeah,
you hear me? Shoot, now. Let's talk about some fighting.
Hey. Well, when you say that, I get the feeling you want to talk about one thing in particular, right?
What's that?
Anthony Joshua and Deontay Wilder, right?
Ooh, well, you already know. You are, man, look. I want to see this fight. I watched the Wilder Ortiz fight, and I watched the Joshua Parker fight. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I'm a boxing novice. I will admit, and I've said it on here plenty of times, boxing is not necessarily my sport. You know, I like watching it. I've watched it over the years. You know, Lennox Lewis, Mike Tyson, all these. I've watched boxing, but boxing is not necessarily my sport. Football is my sport. That's my number one sport. But you are a boxing enthusiast, so that's why I prefer to have someone like you come on the line and talk about some boxing. So, you know, first thing first, let's talk about the Joshua Parker fight. Did you see the fight? And from your perspective as a boxing enthusiast, what did you think about the fight, and what are your ideas moving forward from this fight between like a Joshua Wilder fight, if you even think that would happen?
I think it's going to happen. I honestly think the promoters for both camps, because, you know, you got a lot of people saying Joshua's been ducking Wilder and blah, blah, blah. And then there are people on the other side saying Wilder's been ducking Joshua as well as ducking the Klitschko brothers when they were active, as well as ducking other people. And,
right.
you know, the fight game doesn't quite work like that. You know, the promoters have a lot to do with who you fight. Your job
right.
as a fighter
right.
is to get in the ring and take out whoever's put in front of you, but you really don't have a lot of say in who's put in front of you until you develop a level of clout that both Anthony Joshua and Deontay Wilder are just now getting to, and their managers still have a lot of control over what they're doing
right.
with Anthony Joshua being promoted by Hearn and Deontay Wilder being promoted by Lou DiBella. So
basically you're saying the general audience shouldn't get used to what Floyd doing because only Floyd can do that.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. The only people outside of Floyd that could do what Floyd was doing the end of his career, selecting his own opponents, would be like a Bernard Hopkins because he managed himself for 10 years.
Right.
So you get into guys like that who not only are they the fighters, but they're also their own promoters. They're, you know, their own managers. And it's not a lot of boxers that can do that. So if you're concerned about a fighter ducking another fighter, then 9 times out of 10, look up and see if they have a promoter or not, if they're signed to a promotion company. If they are, chances are great that they could want to fight this person with all their heart. And the fight ain't going to happen if the promoter don't want it to happen. Fighters do
right.
get protected. That does happen. But that's not something that you can blame the fighters for. That's something that you blame the game for. So
right.
I saw the Joshua Parker fight. It was a good fight. It was an interesting fight. I think Parker proved that he was better than
yeah,
a lot of people gave him credit
definitely.
For.
Definitely.
What go ahead.
Well, no, this was my first time actually watching both of them fight. But I understood the aura and the hype that Joshua had coming into the fight. And
right.
looking at his record and talking to you and Jamie about both of them, because, you know, the last time we was on the Freedom Train, we was talking about it, and I was just completely wrong about what I was saying about Wilder, and y'all promptly corrected me, right? but just the fact that Joseph Parker, for me, being the nobody, and to me, the real reason Parker lost that fight, and he kind of see the fight run away from him, was conditioning. Like he wasn't in as good a shape as Joshua. So like the middle of that 10th round, you start to see the separation because Joshua has better conditioning than Parker.
And I think the other thing to that is Joshua fights, the way he fights, he's a heavy pressure fighter, constantly coming forward. He's a big guy. At 6'6", what is he like, 6'6", 200 plus, 230 plus pounds. So he's a big guy, and he's constantly running forward, and he hits hard. Like, Deontay Wilder does have unbelievable power in his right hand. A lot of that is his frame, how lanky he is. We've seen the same thing with tall, lanky fighters. When they deliver that back straight, that thing comes through with the voice of God attached to it. We saw it on Tommy Hearns. He was a real tall welterweight / middleweight. Deontay Wilder, 6'7". He's tall. He's lanky. He's got a lot of extension on that right hand when he brings it back. But he hits hard. What is often taken for granted is how hard Anthony Joshua hits. And he doesn't hit as hard as Deontay Wilder, but is not that much weaker. And he has that power in both hands. With Deontay Wilder, if you stay away from his right, you can survive. Good luck staying away from it for a whole fight. But if you can stay away from it, you're good. With Anthony Joshua, both hands are coming. He's a pressure fighter. And when you do wrap him up, he leans on you. I don't know if people notice that, but he's leaning all of his weight forward every time they're in a clinch, which is even more tiring. So you're getting beat on by this dude that's heavy-handed. He's constantly coming forward, and he's leaning on you when you get close. That's going to wear anybody down. It just is. So, you know, that was a good fight. It was a good fight. Like I said, Parker was better than we gave him credit for. I think at this point, everybody kind of knows what Anthony Joshua is. We found out really what was in Anthony Joshua during the Vladimir Klitschko fight, where he got dropped, got up, and won the fight.
Right.
You know, that really showed us where he was, his ability to take punishment and whatnot. So I like that fight. Deontay Wilder fighting Luis Ortiz, that was another good fight, in my opinion. I think Deontay Wilder called it a low-reward, high-risk fight for him.
Right.
I don't agree with that summation because Luis Ortiz is a legit monster. Now, I know a lot of people would look at his record, be like, well, he only got 28 wins. How much of a monster could he be? But this man came up through the Cuban amateur circuit. They tend to – you tend to be in those amateur programs in Cuba for a long time. This man accumulated over 350 amateur fights.
Damn. So he was kind of – he was a extra professional before he even hit the professional rank.
Right, right. Right. I mean, the man, he's 39 now because he was born in 79.
Mm-hmm.
But he, you know, his record in the amateurs was, I'm looking at it right now, 349-19. So when people say that he was a legit contender, not only coming up through the Cuban boxing circuit, which, you know, they have a good boxing program, but he accumulated 349 wins in that circuit with only 19 losses, this man was a legit threat. Legit.
Right.
And so you can't get caught up in his professional record being 28 and 0 when he fought Wilder, and it's 28-1 now. But the interesting part to that was he was actually doing pretty good. He was doing the exact same thing we've seen. We've seen Gerald Washington do it to Deontay Wilder. We saw I can't say the dude's name, but you know what I'm talking about. Maybe you don't. Spilka.
I'm calling him Spilka.
Spilka, whatever. We saw him do the same thing. We've kind of seen this trend. You can outbox Deontay Wilder. He's not a boxer.
I can see that. Right, he's a fighter.
He is.
Because his defense is horrible.
Horrible.
Yeah. So
no, I'm gonna say it. Deontay Wilder has no defense. He relies on his athleticism to keep him out of trouble.
He fight like he in the streets.
He does. And that's why you can outbox him. He's exciting though, because he fights like he's out in the streets, and he has a right hand that was blessed by God himself.
Mm-hmm.
So at any given time, you can never count this man out, because all it takes is one right hand to change the whole dynamics of the fight. But he has no defense whatsoever. He goes to the Muhammad Ali, Roy Jones Jr. school of defense, which is, I'ma just move my head and hope you miss me. My hands aren't up. I'm not on guard. I'm going to just try to anticipate your punch and move as quickly as I can. And we see what happened to both of them when they got too old to move their heads.
Well, see, and the thing is, Roy was not blessed with the chin that Ali was.
Right.
And Ali was legit old. He was like,
right,
because he had time taken away from him. But Ali still was able to come back and show that brilliance, but his chin was exceptional. Roy Jones didn't have that. So when Roy met Tarver, it was over.
Right. And that's something about Ali that what you just said, people really don't talk about, because they talk about the rope-a-dope, which is actually probably one of the worst defensive strategies you could employ in a boxing match. It looks good, makes the opponent look like an idiot, but you got to remember, even glancing blows to the head are still blows to the head.
Right.
But Ali, one of the best attributes about Ali, in my opinion, was his chin. The man could take a punch.
Mm-hmm.
Amazingly take a punch. I mean, he took a whole bunch of them from George Foreman.
Right. Right.
So, but, you know, with Deontay Wilder, we've seen he doesn't have that chin either. He's been rocked and wobbled on more than a few occasions.
Mm-hmm.
More than a few occasions. So, you know, when you go back to, you know, because a lot of people get caught up in records. Deontay Wilder is 40-0. Anthony Joshua is 21-0. Anthony Joshua spent a little bit more time in the amateurs. Anthony Joshua's amateur record is 40-3. Deontay Wilder's amateur record is 30-5. So, you know, again, Deontay is about 3 or 4 years older, but Anthony Joshua also spent a little bit more time in the amateurs getting fine-tuned, getting honed, developing his skill sets, whereas Deontay Wilder just, you know, after the Olympics, I think after his second Olympics, he just kind of hopped out there. And, you know, he's doing what he's doing. So in terms of the fight, I think it'll happen.
Who do you think will win?
If Parker can prove early on, and I don't think he can, but if he can
Joshua.
Absorb or stop the right hand of Deontay Wilder, I give it to Parker, because that's really all Deontay Wilder has.
You mean Joshua?
If Deontay Wilder can stop Anthony Joshua's.
Yeah.
If Anthony Joshua can stop Deontay Wilder's.
Yeah.
Right hand. I'm sorry, I get Anthony Joshua and Joseph Parker. And.
Nah, cause I was saying, you finna confuse, because you finna confuse me, because I just met two of them. So.
Nah, if Anthony Joshua can stop, neutralize, or even prove that he has the chin to absorb the right hand of Deontay Wilder, then Anthony Joshua wins the fight. Easy.
But doesn't it kind of seem like Joshua would be the person who walks right into a right hand from Wilder, though?
He will. And I say that because he doesn't have a lot of head movement, and he's a pressure fighter, so he's constantly moving forward, and his head isn't really moving. Now, that works in two ways, because Wilder is a slow starter at that. He really doesn't throw that right hand to kill until it's the middle rounds or he feels like he has to. So, you know, you really don't see that right hand coming a lot in the earlier rounds unless somebody is weakened, somebody is wobbled from another punch or whatever, and then you'll start to see him unleash it. But I've seen enough of his fights to know that he is a slow starter. If Anthony Joshua can take advantage of him being a slow starter and kind of maybe get in his head a little bit, impose his will a little bit, and then avoid that right hand, Anthony Joshua has all the tools to win this fight. Deontay Wilder has that right hand, though, that can't be discounted. It just can't.
Right.
So I agree with what you're saying. Deontay Wilder, Anthony Joshua does tend to walk in with no head movement, and that's particularly difficult against somebody like Deontay Wilder, who his style is very unorthodox. He presents punches that boxers haven't seen before. They come from all kinds of crazy angles. They come from all kinds of silly directions, and it's hard to predict. I mean, I've seen him throw punches where he'll hit guys with the bottom palm of his hand, with the base of his hand, like he's slapping the tetherball. You know, but the other thing that Wilder does is he punches with his chin up. And Anthony Joshua has been known to throw a mean uppercut. And he also, I've seen in several slow motion footages, Deontay Wilder will punch with his eyes closed.
Okay.
Reeks of amateur boxing, but he does do it. That's why I say there are weaknesses there for Joshua to take advantage of. And I don't want to say this. I know I'm going long, but I want to say this. I do understand why everybody is excited about Deontay Wilder. He's an exciting fighter. He's knocking people out. it's exciting to see. Everybody loves a good knockout. They do. That's why they hated Floyd Mayweather, because he stopped knocking people out.
Right.
And he became a bad guy. But really, Floyd's mouth isn't too much worse than Deontay Wilder's mouth. Deontay Wilder is just knocking people out.
And they named the damn show ain't worse than Conor McGregor's, but, you know.
No, no. But the thing, for a boxing purist like me, I look at it differently. Like, I'm looking at the quality of your opponents, which that's not Deontay Wilder's fault that he's coming up in a division that's extremely weak. It is his fault that he's been boxing for the last 10 years and never bothered to fight a Klitschko brother. That is his fault. Well, not his fault, but that's his camp's fault. But beyond that, it's not his fault that he doesn't have quality opponents to really measure himself up against. You look at Anthony Joshua's record, it ain't too much better. He just has one of the Klitschko brothers on there. And that right. one Klitschko brother demolishes all 40 of the people that Deontay Wilder has fought. But so I understand the excitement behind Deontay Wilder, and I get why people are amped. And then, too, he's a black dude, so I get that. You know, you and then you got the dynamic of black people in America. You know, we got some sort of competition with black British people. I don't understand that, even though Anthony Joshua has a tattoo of Africa on his body. But, you know, so I get all of that. But looking at it from purely a boxing standpoint, I have to give Anthony Joshua the slight edge.
Okay. Okay, okay, okay. Well, y'all hear it first right here on the Fix Sports Podcast, where we break it down, the Joshua Wilder fight that's going to happen. And as of right now, Pat is saying that Joshua, I can see that, because looking at both of them fight, Joshua's stuff is more compact together, and Joshua looked like he'd been boxing longer than Wilder, and Wilder is like a good fighter, because at any given time, that right fighter catch Wilder, he done.
Right.
So I can see that. But you know, we're gonna keep our eye on that. Now, moving forward a little bit, I do want to ask you about this. So, and I think I sent you the clip of Deontay Wilder saying that he wanted to catch a body in the ring.
Yeah.
And what's this guy? Marukio Suleiman, whoever, is, I guess he with the WBC boxing. And he said this is a serious, well, if you don't know, let me go back. If you don't know, Deontay Wilder was on the Breakfast Club either last week before last, and Deontay Wilder, while on the interview with the Breakfast Club, was saying that he wants to kill somebody in the ring. He's saying that's one of his goals, is to kill somebody. He ain't trying to. But if you kill somebody in the ring, that'd be good. So, Marcurio Solomon, guy from the WBC, he tweeted out about that. He caught wind of that. And he's saying this is a serious report which cannot go unattended. And if true, goes against the WBC boxing code of ethics. It's not acceptable. And the WBC disciplinary committee will look into this delicate matter. I have known Bronze Bomber for a long time, and Bronze Bomber is Deontay Wilder's Twitter handle. I've known Bronze Bomber for a long time. I respect him and do not believe he should say that he wants to kill somebody in the ring. So, you know, the WBC is like all up in arms about this, or they're on high alert. What's your thoughts about this?
Well, his nickname is the Bronze Bomber. That's his boxing alias, and that's actually him paying homage to Joe Louis. Joe Louis was known as the Brown Bomber.
Right.
And I believe Joe Louis is actually from Alabama as well. So,
right.
You know, I just give that little tidbit of information. And so far as him wanting to catch a body in the ring, here's the deal with that, and we talked about it, but I do think people are being overly sensitive. I do think that. I don't think he really wants to kill somebody. I think that's just him hyping himself up, him going into persona mode. You know, we've heard other boxers talk about when they get in the ring and they go into kill mode, and they're not concerned about the other person's safety. They're concerned about destroying people. You know, we've heard boxers talk about going to war. You know what I'm saying? So we've heard all this before. But I think just recently, maybe 3 or 4 weeks before he made that comment, there was a boxer killed in the ring. And then I think a little bit before that even, there was another boxer killed in the ring. So, you know, I think the timing is just bad. When you've had 2 or 3 boxers killed in the ring, and then you have one of the biggest stars on the stage in America come out and make a statement like that, they felt like they had to respond.
Yeah.
And so I get that angle. But on the other end, I do think they blowing it all out of proportion, man. You know, like, stop being soft, man. Stop being, you know, like, that's some bitch shit.
Right.
But we just being honest.
Yeah, they being interesting. Now, I may not have said that, but I do think they're being extra sensitive.
They are. They're being extremely sensitive. Now, I don't think that it's anything against him per se. Like, you got a lot of people talking about the boxing commission is trying to tear the black man down. I honestly can't ride with that. I can't. I just don't see that. We could go into all of the various different reasons why I don't see that, but that would stretch the show out even longer, the boxing segment. But I don't see that. But I will say, you know, if you look at Marvelous Marvin Hagler, the middleweight from the 80s and 90s, if you look at him, he was doing several interviews talking about how his mentality was war and how when he goes into the boxing ring, he's going in to do battle. You know, it's not saying I want to catch a body, but what happens when you go to war? You kill people.
Right.
So
I mean, it's a gladiator sport.
Right. Right, and you have people talking about it like it's a gladiator. You know, look, there's only been one boxer I've ever seen in the two boxers in the history of boxing that have ever shown any real regard for their opponent's life in the ring. One was Roy Jones when he told the referee during the middle of his fight with I forget the guy's name. He stopped in the middle of the fight and was told the referee, "You need to stop this fight because I'm going to kill this guy." And he proceeded to knock the guy out. And then you go all the way back to Ray Robinson, who actually canceled the fight he was finna have with a guy because he had a dream that he was going to kill the guy. And they rescheduled the fight, and he ended up killing the guy.
Wow.
And he ended up retiring after that, but he eventually came back with money problems. But even when he came back, he was never quite the same boxer. So those are the only two instances that I've ever heard of a boxer showing a level of concern for their opponent. So let's stop acting like these guys want to be friendly and nice and hug each other and all that other stuff when they're in that boxing mode.
Well, shoot. There you have it, folks. He's not only a boxing enthusiast, he got his history down pat. Hell, I didn't know that. Goddamn, there it is. So, y'all make sure y'all stay tuned because we're going to have various boxing updates, especially as time leads up to the Wilder Joshua fight and when the fight happens and post-fight analysis and all those things. But appreciate you, Pat, man. I want to have you on. I had you on here talking all day long, man. I appreciate you, man.
All right, man. Thank you for having me.
Yes, sir.
Hey.
Huh?
Don't go in too bad on your rant, okay?
Hey, man, Connor. No, Gary Owens going to get it. More so than Connor. Gary Owens going to get it, though.
Yeah. All right, man. I'm ringing the doorbell. I'm opening it up, and I'm leaving the shop.
There it is. So, there you have it, my man Patrick Irvin. Remember, you can catch him on Lessons from the Screen every Thursday. And also my co-host for the Freedom Train podcast series, which comes out every Wednesday. So let's talk about some basketball. Ogun Mwale. Ogun Mowale. So the results of the women's NCAA tournament final, the championship game between number one Notre Dame and number one Mississippi State, and this game went down to the wire. And it ended up with Ogun Mowale in dramatic fashion, the same way she did against UConn in the semifinal, hit the last second shot, the three-pointer, to put Notre Dame up by 3 points and the win against Mississippi State. And my little homegirl, Itty Bitty, did not win her championship. So Mississippi State has been eliminated in the championship game 2 years in a row. Maybe next year, maybe Mississippi State, yeah, maybe next year. But they have been eliminated in the championship game 2 years in a row. And Ogun Mowale with the big-time shot once again propels Notre Dame to victory with a 61-58 victory in the NCAA Women's Tournament Final. And so I'll give you a little stats. For Notre Dame, Jay Shepherd had 19 points. Kay Westbell had 6. M. Mabry had 10. Ogun Mowale had 18. Young had 6. And Nelson had 2. And for Mississippi State, let me get this together. But for Mississippi State, T. McCowan had 18. Vivian's fine too, but V. Vivian's had 21. R. Johnson had 3. Schaefer had 6. William had 6. Danbury had 2. Holmes had 2. And, you know, Mississippi State, they came to ball, but Ogun Mowale got ice in their veins. And they were and one of the cool things after the game, they were saying, after she hit the shot, they was like, ice, ice, ice. And she made the reference to have ice in her veins. Because, you know, it's only like 5 people with ice in their veins in this world, and I'm one of them people. I was born with ice in my veins. So Ogun Mowale, I'm talking about almost in similar fashion to what she did in the UConn game, caught the ball on that right baseline, dribbled up a bit behind that three-point line, pulled it, cranked it, bam, splashed it. The game is over. Ogun Mowale. Ogun Mowale. Ogun Mowale. Ogun Mowale. Ogun Mowale. Hey, hey, hey. Ogun Mowale. So one time for Notre Dame for winning the 2018 Women's NCAA Championship. One time for Ogun Mowale for being the tournament MVP and hitting 2 game-winning shizats. So, for the men's side, Villanova versus Michigan. And once again, Florida State could have been in the national championship game, but they decided not to score for 10 minutes. So, but number one, Villanova versus number three, Michigan. And Villanova comes up with the victory. And my man, my new homeboy, DiVincenzo, is the game. And DiVincenzo went slap off. I'm talking about slap off because Brunson, the player of the year, he had a horrible game. But DiVincenzo decided to drop 31 on these boys and lead Villanova to a 79-62 victory. Basically, Villanova went on a run to end the first half. So went on a run to end the first half. And coming out in the second half, Michigan just could not keep up. DiVincenzo just dropping them goddamn beans on people and busting people all in their nose. So let me get the stats. So Bridges had 19. Spellman had 8. Pascal had 6. Brunson had 9. Booth had 2, DiVincenzo had 31, and Gillespie had 4. So DiVincenzo carried these boys in this game to victory, basically, because the only other person that was in double digits was Bridges. So DiVincenzo carried these boys, and he straight balled. It was like one play where the Michigan player got loose coming to the goal to dunk the ball with 2 hands, and it was like a two-hand. Dude coming to bound the ball with 2 hands, DiVincenzo went up, blocked the shot with 2 hands, and DiVincenzo was looking like he live out there. And now, what's funny is they call him Billy Hoyle They called DiVincenzo Billy Hoyle, saying he's, you know, a white man can't jump, you know, Billy Hoyle from white men. But, you know, Billy Hoyle, I mean, Billy Hoyle had a shot, though. Billy Hoyle had a shot. Billy Hoyle was a baller in the movie, but DiVincenzo did his thing. And 79-62. So the game going into the game wasn't close. It wasn't as close as it should have been. Michigan was outclassed. So Wagner from Michigan had 16. Livers had zero. Abdul Rahman had a very, very, very good tournament. Abdul Rahman did. He had 23. Simpson had 10. Matthews had 6. Robinson had 0. Poole had 3. And Teske had 2. And Watson had 2. But, man, look. One time for Villanova, man. Also, all the folks around that Philly area, man. One time for Villanova for going out, doing their thing, and bringing home the 2018 NCAA championship, and Villanova is the winner of 2 of the last 3 national championships. So, one time for Villanova, one time for Notre Dame, and, you know, we want to give that round of applause for both Villanova and Notre Dame for dropping them beans on people doing their thing. You know what I'm saying? One time for your mind. One time for your mind. And I wonder who's winning these rings. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Catch me at the Apollo Theater in a little bit. All right. So, Kyrie Irving, he hurt. Kyrie Irving is hurt. And that is not good for the Celtics, right? Because the Celtics are trying to win a championship. Now, the Boston Celtics have relinquished their number one seed in the East to the Toronto Raptors. The Toronto Raptors are the number one seed in the East. Boston Celtics are number 2. Cleveland Cavs are number 3. So the question is now, what happens to the Celtics moving forward? The Celtics are going to the playoffs. They are going to play in the playoffs, but the Celtics don't get housed in the playoffs. That's just pretty much what's going to happen to them. They're going to get housed in the playoffs because no Gordon, no Irving. So with no Gordon and no Irving, the Celtics just not going to have what it takes to compete with a Washington or a Toronto or a Cleveland. I mean, and they're just not. And the thing is with Kyrie is his knees going to be a continuous issue moving forward in his career? And if he has bad knees, how bad are his knees? Because remember, in the finals 2 years ago, no, 3 years ago, matter of fact, the finals 3 years ago, when the 2015, when the Cavs were playing against the Warriors, really the only reason why the Warriors have 2 rings is that first ring, because LeBron was 1-on-3 playing against Steph, Draymond, and Klay, and Kyrie and Kevin Love were hurt, so that's why LeBron lost that one. But you know, Kyrie Irving, this is the first time he has been the leader on the team, and the team is going into the playoffs, going to playoffs, period, but also going to the playoffs in this position when he's the de facto leader of the team. So my concern from the beginning was, can Kyrie really can Kyrie straight up really lead and carry this team and drag this team into the playoffs, lead this team to the playoffs, and lead this team deep to the playoffs? And that's still a question mark because Buddy hurt. So with him being hurt, we won't be able to see that next year. Well, this year. We won't be able to see that next year, this year. But what's exciting is, you know, we'll see that Gordon Irvin next year. So let me read this article to you from NBC Sports. Celtics guard Kyrie Irving will undergo a procedure to remove two screws implanted in his left patella after the patella fracture he suffered during the NBA Finals 2015. So the surgery is supposed to be Saturday the 7th, right? Following a mid-March procedure to remove a tension wire that had been implanted at the same time as the screws, pathology indicated the presence of a bacterial infection at the site of the hardware. To ensure that no infection remains in the knee, the screws will be removed. The fracture in Irving's patella has completely healed, and his knee remains structurally sound. He is expected to make a full recovery in 4 to 5 months. This will shut down any thoughts of Irving returning in the playoffs. There will be questions of whether he's ready for the start of training camp. The Celtics give a timeline on Irving's injury, knee injury that will have him back around to start the playoffs in several weeks. Turns out he'll miss the entire season. They're talking about this season. So, and this is according to Adrian Wojnarowski. In the aftermath of the knee surgery, Boston Celtics All-Star Kyrie Irving will miss the rest of the regular season and playoffs, according to league sources. This is devastating to Boston, which falls from a legitimate Eastern Conference challenger to a team susceptible to losing in the first round, which is true, even though Boston does have a nice core and Boston has a good, great coaching, and they play defense, but they just don't have that star that could take them over to the next level. I wouldn't say Boston will probably lose in the first round, but Boston could very well lose in the first round. But Boston, to me, has the mindset of they could possibly lose in the second round, but I wouldn't be surprised if they do lose in the first round. The Celtics will probably finish with the number 2 seed without Irving. They're not necessarily better than the Heat, Bucks, or Wizards, potential first-round foes. Right, so Gordon Hayward and Daniel Theis as Boston. Those are two other Boston players who were injured for the season. And like with Hayward, rumors could still emerge about Irving returning if the Celtics advance far enough. Today's leak could be about Boston trying to preemptively shut down speculation and questions about Irving's availability. But winning a series of two obviously becomes far more difficult without these stars. So. Without Gordon Hayward, without Kyrie Irving, I don't see the Boston Celtics going that much further into the playoffs. I don't see the Boston Celtics being a legitimate threat to the Cavaliers. So that would mean the only other team who would possibly be a legitimate threat to the Cleveland Cavaliers would be the Toronto Raptors. But we will see how that plays out. But for right now, Kyrie Irving will not be playing anymore this season for the late Boston Celtics. So, you know. My bad. I mean, sorry for you, Celtics. I ain't gonna say my bad. I ain't doing nothing wrong. But sorry for you, Celtics, man. Look. Next year, Boston Celtics. Next year. That's all I got to say about that. Next year. Because, yeah. Y'all not. I mean, I didn't think the Celtics was going to win with Irving, but they damn sure ain't going to win without. No Irving, no Gordon. Boston ain't important. No Irving, no Gordon. Boston ain't important. Toot-toot-loo. All right. So, moving on, like Maya. So, this was almost my weekly rant. I don't know. I found something better for the rant, but Nick Saban and LeBron James going back. More so LeBron going at Nick Saban about the barbershop series. So Alabama has a show called Shop Talk. LeBron James has a show called The Shop. And basically both shows are based around athletes sitting in barbershops talking about sports, life, and other things. LeBron had his show first, then Nick Saban came out with his show. Now, LeBron James' show is not original in concept of a person or people in the barbershop filming themselves talking smack. It may not even be original in the idea of athletes, an athlete-led show that goes in and talks about sports and life. I don't think it's unique in that. But I did look for other current shows, and maybe my search was garbage. Maybe. I will admit if it was garbage, it was garbage. But I didn't find any other shows at this point led by athletes or anybody in the athletic realm that was interviewing or having conversations in a barbershop about sports and life, other than the Shop Talk that Nick Saban does. And so apparently LeBron James has an issue with that. So let me read this to you from NBA.com or CBS Sports. Alabama head coach Nick Saban apparently has no intention of canceling Alabama's unreleased Shop Talk, a video series featuring former Alabama wide receiver Julio Jones engaging Saban and other players for a barbershop chat. It seems like a cool idea. So why would he cancel it? Well, simply because LeBron James is claiming he's already done it in his series The Shop, and that Saban's format is infringing upon LeBron James' copyright claims. Now, for this, I will say white people do be stealing. We know if white people good at one thing, it's stealing. So I'm not saying Nick Saban is stealing, but I'm not saying Nick Saban not stealing. But I will point out the fact that white people do steal. And white men in particular are the biggest thieves that planet Earth has ever seen. So I will say that. But I can't directly say that in this Nick Saban is stealing, but Nick Saban ain't original in what he's doing either. So as ESPN reports, James' media platform Uninterrupted sent Alabama a letter citing concerns about the format of Shop Talk, lifting elements from the Shop. Per ESPN, an excerpt from the letter read, "Your continued exploitation of Shop Talk infringes Uninterrupted's copyright, trademark rights, and other valuable intellectual property rights in the Shop, and significantly damages Uninterrupted's commercial prospects for the Shop." On Monday, ESPN told by an Alabama spokeswoman that the university received Uninterrupted's complaint and would review the matter. It then said that a dialogue was taking shape between the two sides as legal representation to address the issue. Saban's Tuesday press conference addressed the letter, with Saban saying that he has no intention to pull the series. He also said that the idea has been used enough that Shop Talk hardly has copyright claim over. And you know, that's from Saban. And I will admit, that's not the first time somebody got into a barbershop, talked about sports. It may not even been led by an athlete and put it out there like that. But it's not the first time it's happening. But LeBron James is doing it right now, and Saban and did come behind that. So I will say that. So as CBS Sports noted, however, the similarities stretch a bit further than simply having a familiar format. They also have similar topics and names that can easily be conflicted with another. After the Cavaliers beat the Raptors on Tuesday night, James addressed Saban's comments, and they have videos in my face now. There's videos of both LeBron James and Nick Saban talking about the issue. LeBron James is saying that they're stealing. Saban saying, "We ain't stealing, and we're going to keep doing it." LeBron James like, "Y'all stealing, y'all need to stop doing it." So I want to know what you guys think. Tweet me at JoeWar84 or tweet at Freedom Train Network. At Freedom Train Net. Tweet. I want to know what you guys think about this. I want to know what are your thoughts about Nick Saban and LeBron James's feud over the Shop Talk and the intellectual property and the copyrights, everything that has to do with this, because, you know, white people do be stealing. White people do be stealing. I mean, now let me read this. I think you guys know Nick Saban more than me from a media perspective. He said to reporters after the game, and this is LeBron James saying this, "You guys know Nick Saban more than I do, so that's exactly what I think he would say. I built Uninterrupted for a reason, and for us athletes to have a platform to be able to speak about whatever we want to talk about. I respect him as a coach, but I'd be damned if I allow someone to use our platform and try to do the same thing we're doing and think it's just okay, so the lawyers will figure it out." It says, while Shop Talk doesn't have any episodes aired, the Shop has 2 episodes available. Neither sides look to back down on the issue and all those things. So this is something we're going to keep our eye on with Nick Saban and LeBron James. Like I say, LeBron James isn't necessarily totally original in this. Nick Saban damn sure ain't original in this. But to be fair, LeBron James was doing it first. I believe, especially in the realm of sports, that, well, just in any realms, if we're in the same realm, I just believe that, you know, if I'm going to do a show, it should be, I should be able to have different elements. Now, I'm not for or against either side on this. I don't know. I need more information. Don't have a lot of information to really make an educated, informed decision on who I would go in on. Whether I say LeBron James being soft or say Nick Saban stealing. I know people would love for me to go in on LeBron, and if he deserves it, I will, and people would love for me to go in on Nick. All I do know is the one thing that's constant in this is white people do be stealing. We do know that. So we're going to keep our eye on this to see what's going on with this series, Shop Talk. Hey, man, this is my I'm audio Shop Talk, so they can't say I'm stealing nothing. Because, hey, this is a podcast. I ain't in no barbershop, and we ain't even got no hair clipper signs. I can pluck some hair off my face and on my head and throw it on the ground, but, you know. Hey, so we're going to keep our eye on that. So let's move forward and talk a little bit of hockey. Seems that the Las Vegas Golden Knights is the NHL, the National Hockey League's expansion team, and they have made the playoffs. Expansion teams don't make playoffs. But the Las Vegas Golden Knights have made the playoffs in their very first season of existence. And so I was like, hey, I got to talk about that. I have to talk about the Las Vegas Golden Knights and how what they got going on, what they're doing, and how they got to where they are now, because I just think it's remarkable. You know, me understanding the work that it takes to make playoffs and the understanding that it takes to build good teams and to come out of the gate to have a playoff team already built and to make the playoffs. Man, hey, that's what's up. So apparently the Golden Knights, they defeated the Colorado Avalanche in a 4-1 victory, which propelled them to the playoffs. I mean, the Las Vegas Golden Knights beat the Colorado Avalanche 4-1, and that propelled them to the playoffs. So I think that's cool. Let me read this article to you. By the New York Times. The Las Vegas Golden Knights choose to celebrate a monumental moment for the franchise by thinking back to how its inaugural season began, hoping the new hockey team could bring smiles to a city reeling from tragedy. And they're still saying that the city is reeling from the tragedy of the Las Vegas shooter. So shortly after Vegas became the first expansion team to clinch a playoff berth with a 4-1 victory over the Colorado Avalanche on Monday night. The mantra in the locker room was the same as the one adopted shortly before the team's home opener, Vegas Strong. Because, you know, they're using the shooter thing. So Vegas Strong. Team owner Bill Foley, the veteran goalie Marc-Andre Fleury. Oh, Marc-Andre Fleury played for them? Okay. Marc-Andre Fleury, feel like he's been in hockey since I was in high school. And the leading scorer, William Carlson, were among those who thought back Monday on the October 1st mass shooting that killed 58 and injured hundreds more on the Las Vegas Strip. Now, let me just say this. Never mind, because tragedies can spur players, but I think in athletics, when tragedies happen, you can use that energy. But don't just use the energy. Give back. After you use the energy to win and accumulate money, give back. And put forth energy and effort to try to be a part of the change to help these things to not ever happen again. That's what I would say. Okay, it was a disaster that night. It was a terrible massacre. We changed our initial opening night ceremonies. I thought we really connected with the town. I'm so proud of the whole team, Foley said. From then on, it was pretty unbelievable. We got off to that fast start. We survived a lot of challenges this year besides being an expansion team who nobody picked to do anything. No expansion team had ever made the playoffs since the league expanded for the 1967-68 season. It doesn't bring anybody back or we don't heal anybody, Fleury said, but I hope that we've changed people's mind a bit and get them to come here, have a good time at T-Mobile and be proud of their hometown team. Remember now, white people have the luxury of escaping these things because they don't live in an oppressive society that look that systematically oppresses them. So white people have the luxury of escaping. Black people don't, because no matter what, we're still under a system of oppression, right? So Alex Tooch, Jonathan Morris, Shea Theodore, and Carlson each scored while Fleury improved to a 28-11-4 record after stopping 28 shots. It was also the 200th career victory for Coach Gerald Gallen. Okay, one time for Gerald, one time for Marc-Andre Fleury, one time for Gerald Gallen. I'm really happy about making the playoff. The 200th win doesn't mean a whole lot, Gallen said. We always go back to our first home game. It wasn't about our team winning. It wasn't about nothing. It was about the first responders and the tragedy that happened the week before that. So that's what spurred Vegas into this season, and Vegas is using that momentum on the playoffs, kind of reminiscent of the New Orleans Saints after what happened with Katrina when they finally was able to come back into the Superdome and play. And then, you know, it kind of spurred the Saints to go on and win the Super Bowl. But it's kind of reminiscent of that. I think that was the 2008 year, so that's kind of like 10 years later. So, you know, give y'all a little update on hockey. So Las Vegas, one time for Las Vegas, and I keep y'all up on them and what they got going on in the National Hockey League playoffs. And I will go out. I'm not going out on a limb, but I will make it known on this show, The Fix, the realest and the blackest sports podcast you have ever heard. I will go out and say that the NHL, the National Hockey League, has the best professional, probably the best, period, but one of the best, if not the best, I'm going to say the best professional playoff format. I do think some of these college sports have good formats, but I love the NHL's playoff format. And I love that you never know who's going to win. So I do love that about hockey playoffs and just stuff like that. I look forward to the hockey playoffs all the time. Oh, yeah, side note for y'all, too. World Cup coming up in June and July. I'm rooting for the team with the most black people. I'm telling you all the time. I know I live in America, but I'm rooting for the team with the most black people. So I'm going to let y'all know what's going on with this World Cup when it happens. But World Cup is about to start, and also NFL like flag football competition tournament starting in like June and July. So I'm gonna tell y'all more about that as it comes up. Now, give y'all a little black history, some black history. How many of us knew that the first three decades of the Kentucky Derby was dominated by black jockeys? I know I didn't until I saw something about it and did my research. So let's get into it. Let's learn a little black history. Hey, this is the realest and the blackest sports show, right? So let's learn some black history about the black jockeys out here doing their thing. So although African-American jockeys may be a rarity now, they dominated the winning circles in the race's first three decades, right? That's the opening line. On May 17th, 1875, thousands of Eagle horse racing fans poured through the gates of Churchill Downs to get their first looks at Louisville's sparkling new racetrack and cheer the thoroughbreds in their featured race, the inaugural Kentucky Derby. Finely dressed gentlemen and ladies adorned in bright colors thronged the grandstand, and hundreds of carriages filled the infield as the horses towed the line for the day's second race. At the tap of a drum, 15 horses thundered down the track as excited scouts echoed across the oval. Jockey Oliver Lewis spurred on his chestnut colt, Aristides, to the one-length victory in the fastest time ever recorded by a three-year-old horse. That Lewis was a black man in the sport of horse racing was of little note. In fact, 13 of the 15 riders in the first Kentucky Derby were African Americans. In the years following the Civil War, black jockeys dominated horse racing at a time when it was America's most popular sport. African-American riders were the first black sports superstars in the United States, and they won 15 of the first 28 runnings of the Kentucky Derby. I'm going to read that again. Black people were the first superstars. They say African-American riders were the first black. Oh, well, so horse jockeys were the first black superstars in the United States. The first black sports superstars in the United States were horse jockeys. Get that. For centuries, Southern plantation owners put slaves to work in their stables. Slaves cared for and raced their master's horses. They served as riders, grooms, and trainers, and gained a keen horse sense from spending so much time in the stables. After emancipation, African Americans continued to rule Southern race circuits, while white immigrants from Ireland and England predominated the North. Former slaves and their sons starred at Churchill Downs in the 1800s. Not only was 1875 ridden by an African American, he was trained by a former slave known for superb horsemanship. His name, that slave name, was Ansel Williamson. Much like the equines he conditioned, Williamson was sold from owner to owner. In 1864, R.A. Alexander, proprietor of the famed Woodburn Stud Farm, purchased Williamson. After emancipation, the former slave continued to work for his former master, as did a standout black jockey named Ed Brown, who would train the 1877 Kentucky Derby winner, Baden-Baden, and eventually operate his own racing stable. While the 1800s saw professional baseball draw the color line, not to be broken until the Brooklyn Dodgers called up Jackie Robinson in 1947, which you know how I feel about that. African-Americans continue to thrive on the track. No black riders, however, surpassed Isaac Murphy, considered by some to have been the greatest American jockey in history. Isaac! The son of a former slave, Murphy won an incredible clip. He won at an incredible clip, consistently winning more than a third of his mounts. In 1891, he became the first jockey to win successive runnings of the Kentucky Derby and the first rider to win three overall. A decade later, Jimmy Wingfield matched the back-to-back feat after riding at Alan A. Dale to victory in the 1902 Kentucky Derby. Then suddenly, the rich African-American tradition at Churchill Downs ended. Probably some old cracker stuff. The rising tide of institutional race. See what I told you? I told you the cracker stuff. The rising tide of institutional racism that gilded age America finally seeped into the world of horse racing. Jim Crow was on the ascent, and the U.S. Supreme Court itself blessed segregation in the 1896 Plessy versus Ferguson decision. Emboldened by the social changes, resentful white jockeys at northern raceways conspired to force blacks off the track, in some cases literally. During the 1900 racing season, white jockeys in New York warned trainers and owners not to mount any black riders if they expected to win. They carried out their threats by boxing in black jockeys and riding them in two and sometimes over the rails. And in cruel irony, free sons of former slaves felt the sting of whites directed their ways during races. Race officials looked the other way. Crackers. Owners realized that black riders had little chance of winning given their interference. Even Willie Sims, the only African-American jockey to win all three Triple Crown events, had to beg for a mount. One time for Willie Sims for being a Triple Crown winner. By 1904, black riders had been virtually banned from the major racetracks, including Churchill Downs, and the complexion of the Kentucky Derby had been changed forever. Kentucky Derby and other horse racing was whitewashed. Black participation dwindled, and no African-American rode the race between 1921 and 2000 when Marlon St. Julien glided cruel to a seventh-place finish. Man, cracker stuff. So cracker stuff is the reason why black people don't dominate horse racing anymore. But black people was dominating horse racing, and my dog, Willie Sims, was the first black person to win the Triple Crown. So, hey, man, if y'all ain't heard it ever before, y'all heard it here first on the Fix Sports Podcast, the realest and the blackest sports show you have ever heard in your life. Black people dominated horse racing for the first 3 years of horse racing, and especially the Kentucky Derby would be nothing without black people. So that's your moment of black history, brought to you by On the Shoulders of Giants. who brings you African history at your fingertips and on the go. All right, so let's transition into my favorite sport. My favorite sport is football, as you know. And Brandon Cooks has been traded from the Patriots to the Rams. And on paper, it seems like the Los Angeles Rams are just going to walk into the Super Bowl for the NFC side, probably play the Patriots probably. Because, damn, the Rams got everybody, don't they? As told you last week, they got Sue, they got Tlaib, they got Peters. I forgot the third DB that they added. Damn. So, Brandon Cooks going from the Rams going from the Patriots to the Rams is a great look for the Rams. Give the Rams a downfield threat. I got to check to see what Sammy Watkins is. I'm not sure what exactly happened to Sammy Watkins. I know the last time I checked, Sammy Watkins was playing for the Rams. So, excuse me, I'm looking for it now. But he was traded from the Bills to the Rams. So, where is he now? I think he might still be with the Rams. Oh, no. Excuse me. Sammy Watkins is with the Kansas City Chiefs. Samuel Benjamin Watkins IV plays for the Kansas City Chiefs now. Okay. So we got that out the way. So Brandon Cooks. So we're going to see what comes out of that as far as Cooks and the Rams. But what happened? So the last time the Patriots had two, I don't need to read that. The Rams were clearly interested by us. So the Patriots got the number 23 overall pick and a sixth rounder for Brandon Cooks. And that first round selection is 9 spots higher than the one the Patriots sent to the Saints for Cooks a year ago. So the Patriots did their willing and dealing because, you know, Patriots know how to will and deal and get picks and things, but Bill Belichick is better at free agency and things. So the Rams get Cooks, the Patriots get a first rounder and a sixth rounder, the 23rd pick in the first round to be exact. So, you know, we're gonna see how that happens and see what comes out with that. So I just want to give you all that update on that and what's happening with the Los Angeles Rams. And, you know, as we get closer to the football season, as we get closer, I'll give you updates on the teams. But Brandon Cooks is now a Ram, and Sammy Watkins is a Chief. I still don't trust the Chiefs, though. Okay. So now I wanna do a little breakdown. Like I said last week, I'm gonna start doing my draft preview, and I wanna break down the draft of the at least the first round. So all 32 picks in the first round. I wanna break down team by team. We got time. So this day I'm doing the Browns and the Giants. And we're gonna talk about draft positions, needs and players that they could possibly potentially be looking at. So that's what we want to look at with the Rams and the Giants. So starting off with the Browns and the Giants. So we're going to start off with the Cleveland Browns. And so as you know, like I told you last week, the Cleveland Browns have currently the first and the fourth round pick. So they have two first round picks. They have two first round picks, 3 second round picks, 1 third round pick, 2 fourth round picks, 2 fifth round picks, 1 sixth round pick, 1 seventh round pick. So the Cleveland Browns have going into this draft with a good number of picks that they can choose from. Their offseason needs: quarterback, running back, right tackle, outside linebacker, and cornerback. So quarterback and running back could be addressed immediately in the draft because what they could do is they could draft Saquon Barkley with their number one pick, and then at that number four pick, assuming that they don't move or trade change position or anything, then they can come back and get either Darnold or Rosen or Allen or Mayfield or even Lamar Jackson. And there's been reports out there that the Patriots could end up taking Lamar Jackson. Somebody needs to draft Lamar Jackson. Lamar Jackson is a baller, and I forgot to talk about him last week when I talked about the quarterbacks. But, of course, Lamar Jackson may not go as high as the other ones or may not get the fanfare, but I like Lamar. I like Lamar. So, once again, the needs for the Browns are the quarterback, running back, right tackle, outside linebacker. So, the prospects that they are watching is Sam, of course. We talked about Sam Darnold from USC. We know Darnold, Rosen, those boys. Darius Geis, the running back from LSU. Zachary Crabtree, the right tackle from Oklahoma State. Christian Sam, outside linebacker from Arizona State. Joshua Jackson, the cornerback from Iowa. But still, Saquon Barkley is on the table because depending on if like the Giants or who got the third pick? Who has the third pick? I forgot who got the third pick, but assuming Saquon Barkley is still on the board at the fourth pick. If it's me, if I'm the Browns, Saquon Barkley is still on the board at the fourth pick, I'm taking him. But if I'm the Giants and Saquon Barkley is on the board at the second pick, I'm taking Saquon Barkley. Because we have Eli Manning as our quarterback, and we possibly could find another quarterback to be his successor. But Eli probably got another good 2 years in him. So the Giants do need to start looking for a quarterback in the future. So let me read this. The Browns own 2 first-round picks and 3 second-round picks thanks to being one of the most active teams on the trade market in the last few years. The team earned the Texans first-rounder via the trade, landed Deshaun Watson in Houston, and they took on Brock Osweiler contract in order to land the Texans second-round pick as well. Houston is currently on track to pick 7th. So those trades could position the Browns to pick 4 times in the top 40. After having 4 picks in the top 52, the Browns also won the Eagles' second-round pick by virtue of the trade that landed Carson Wentz to Philadelphia, but that figures to be late in the second round. That's not all the extra picks for the Browns, who own Carolina's 4th-round pick and Kansas City's 5th-round pick. The franchise owns 12 picks in all, has the flexibility to do what they need to move up in this draft. Now, the offseason needs, like I said, quarterback, running back, right tackle, outside linebacker, cornerback. So we'll see how they address them. At running back, we know quarterback for the Browns. They got Tyrod Taylor. Tyrod Taylor is the current quarterback for the Browns, so even if the Browns do bring in a quarterback or draft a quarterback, he's not starting this shit because they got Tyrod Taylor as their quarterback. So as running back, they got Isaiah Crowell, Duke Johnson, and, the offensive line, one of the weaknesses, they're saying Sean Coleman. So, the Browns have a lot of flexibility and a lot of things that they can do, and they have a lot of picks. So I'm looking to see, but if they don't get Barkley, they could get Geis. If Geis was a bad boy coming out of LSU and some of the other running backs. So just keep an eye on that. Just a little mini update on the Cleveland Browns. So the New York Giants, they're I'm a Cowboy, first of all. So I hope the Giants lose. I hope the Giants have a horrible draft. I hope a lot of bad things happen to the Giants football-wise. But their picks have one pick every round. So the Giants have 7 overall picks. They have one pick every round. Like I say, they have the 2nd overall pick this year. So their needs, quarterback, running back, offensive line, linebacker. So let me read this. Assuming Eli Manning has played his final snap for the franchise, the Giants will end the offseason looking to find their starter at quarterback. But I think Eli coming back. While rookie Davis Webb could play well enough in 2017 for the Giants, he played well. A running back, damn all that. The Giants need quarterback, running back, offensive line, linebacker. That's what I'm needing. This commentary not really going to help. So players to watch, Lamar Jackson. Bryce Love, the running back from Stanford. I forgot about Bryce Love. Yeah, Bryce Love. Everybody was on Bryce Love until they started talking about Saquon. So Quentin Nelson, offensive guard for Notre Dame, and look to hear Quentin Nelson's name a lot, because apparently Quentin Nelson is one of the top five best players in the draft. Roquan Smith, he's a baller from Georgia. So those are the some people that they have on that Giants have that I own. The Giants did sign William Gay, big play William Gay, former cornerback of the Pittsburgh Steelers and Arizona Cardinals, but spent 11 seasons with the Pittsburgh Steelers. So William Gay did sign with the New York Giants. Like I say, I'm a Cowboy. But I think that the Giants are – they may take Saquon. And if not, they'll probably take a quarterback. If they take a quarterback, I don't expect it to be Lamar Jackson. I expect more so Darnold or Allen, or maybe even Rosen. Darnold, Allen, or Rosen, or Mayfield. One of those four. We don't know. But we're going to get more information. I mean, we get more as more information is accumulated, we're going to talk more about football and these teams and who they look like they're going to be drafting. So more mock drafts will come out, and I'll give you more on that. So stay tuned with me on that. So my pre-rant warm-up. My pre-rant warm-up is HBO has made a movie about Joe Paterno. Joe Paterno turned out to be a fuckboy. And I know people not going to like this with me saying this, but let's just be real. Any man, like Joe Paterno knew that, what's your boy's name? Sandusky, Jerry Sandusky. Joe Paterno knew that Jerry Sandusky was raping little boys and did nothing about it and even kept the man on his staff. So for that, Joe Paterno, you a fuckboy for that. I mean, straight up and down. You can't harbor a sexual predator. You know the dude is a sexual predator. You can't harbor that and, you know, not expect to be talked about. Now, a lot of people are not going to like me talking about Joe Paterno in that manner, but Joe Paterno fucked up. And winning football games does not give you immunity from being called a fuckboy. Now, Joe Paterno may have made, and I'm pretty sure he has made significant impact on the lives of the players who played for him. But what about the impact that was made, or the negative impact that was made on the lives of the children who was raped due to him turning a blind eye to what Sandusky had going on? So, yeah. So apparently the Paterno movie aired on Saturday night, Saturday, April 7th. So Saturday, April 7th, 8 o'clock, HBO, the Paterno movie aired and has drawn an eclectic mix of reviews from critics about his telling of the fall from grace story of the legendary Penn State football coach Joe Paterno for the role he played in the Jerry Sandusky sex scandal. And Al Pacino is playing Joe Paterno, and they did the makeup pretty straight. He kind of looked like him. Here a collection of expert excerpts from some of the reviews, right? So NPR said the central question of this HBO drama really is, what did Paterno know and when did he know? It doesn't answer that question fully until the very last moment, but it leaves you thinking and reflecting long after the credits roll, which is precisely what makes it so effective. The Chicago Sun-Times says, directed by the veteran Barry Levinson, Rain Man, who did Rain Man, Wag the Dog, The Natural, Good Morning Vietnam, Paterno has the gravitas and scope of a major theatrical release. Los Angeles Times said, the film is watchable, certainly, but also wayward. Its effects feel scattered. Its point lost as the story looks there. Paterno has many things to show you, but less to say. And last one by Salon, The film is not without its flaws. The pacing lags at times, and some of the more interesting subplots are buried under the scenes that repeatedly show paternal, show the paternal clan trying and failing to put out the fire. But it hits home not only because the crimes it profiles are so heinous, so unconsensible, but also the entire subject is so agonizingly relevant today. Right, they're talking about with this Me Too movement. And that's the thing. Little boys were being raped by Joe Paterno's homeboy, Jerry Sandusky. Joe knew about it, and Joe didn't do anything about it. So I don't have HBO, so I'm going to find a way to watch the movie. I didn't watch the movie. I'm going to find a way to watch it. And I will give you a update, and I'm sure I'll get Patrick to do a Lessons from the Screen on it to kind of break that down. But the biggest thing about this, when I found out that they were making a movie about Joe Paterno, is, wow, they make a movie about people who are complicit in sexual assaults. I just feel like Joe Paterno lost all credibility with this. Like, you knew little boys was being raped. Like, you knew that. You knew little boys was being raped by your homeboy. And you covered it up. You covered it up. I believe Joe Paterno died of disappointment in himself. Not heartbreak, because what is he heartbroken about? I don't see what Joe Paterno had, if he was heartbroken. What did he have to be heartbroken about? Because he had a chance to rectify the situation and didn't do it. He had a chance to save people, to help people, and he didn't do it. He decided to save and help his homeboy, which was the villain. So that makes him a co-conspirator and also a co-villain. Right? But I just thought it was very, 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 very interesting that they decided to move ahead with this movie and put this movie out and shed light on Joe Paterno. And my first question was, well, are they trying to save face? Are they trying to make him look good and trying to, you know, like, say, hey, Joe Paterno is not that bad of a person? Well, he is. He is that bad of a person. Because he knew little boys was being raped, and it didn't do anything about it. And we're talking about over a good time. Like, it happened. It was more than 4 or 5 years that this was happening. So this happened a long time, and Paterno knew about it, turned a blind eye. So, yeah, but Joe Paterno, you're a fuckboy for that. He is. He was a fuckboy for that, and. You can't get mad at me for calling it out. If you listen to this, you're like, oh, man, I can't believe he's saying that about Joe Paterno. Well, you should believe I'm saying this about Joe Paterno. If you did this, I would say this about you. If I did this, you should say this about me. Any man, any adult, you can't be the children of our future type person and hear me saying this about Joe Paterno and get all up and on. Joe Paterno fucked up. He did some fuckboy shit. So that's why this happened. The way it happened. That's why he was kicked out of, he was fired from Penn State because they found out he was doing some fuckboy shit, which is not okay. I don't care, like I said earlier, I don't care how many damn football games you win. I don't care how many football games you win. Winning football games does not give you immunity for being called a fuckboy when you know little boys being raped by your homeboy and you turn a blind eye to your homeboy raping little boys and kind of have the program, basically have the program created to where little boys can get raped by your homeboy because they got to come back every summer. They coming back every summer, and you know your homeboy licking his chops, looking at these little boys like, yeah, I'm finna fuck him. I'm finna fuck him. I'm finna fuck him. See, that's my biggest issue with Joe Paterno and everything that's going on, right? Because if you already know how I feel about sexual assault. You know, I'm one of the few people who across the board with the sexual assault thing. But especially me being a black man, knowing that when men are raped, it goes unnoticed, it goes silent. Nobody wants to talk about it. And people like to make it seem like if a man or a little boy is raped, it's his fault, and now he's homosexual now. which is not the case. But men are victims as well, and damn it, I'm here standing up for those boys who are now men who were raped by Jerry Sandusky and his sick ass. Fuck Jerry Sandusky, old bitch ass. And fuck Joe Paterno for housing that sick ass motherfucker and his program. And if you don't like it, that's probably because you got a problem with real morality. And if you don't like it, that's because you got a real problem in making sure that our kids stay safe. I'm about these damn kids. And if you got a problem with me being about these kids, that's because you a fuck boy. Or a pussy hoe. Either one you want to be. If you're a female, you're a pussy hoe. If you're a man, you're a fuck boy. But I don't give a shit who it is. I don't play when it comes to sexual assault stuff. You can't be out here raping kids and trying to get away with it and thinking you're going to get away with it for one, trying to get away with it for one, and then when you get caught, oh, my God. And then, man, fuck. I love football, but fuck football. Football ain't that important. It's about real stuff in this life, because too many of us use sports as an escape from the real world. Like I said, if you black, you don't have the luxury to escape this. But just across the board on some manhood stuff, on some anti-sexual assault stuff, hey, man, fuck Jerry Sandusky and Joe Paterno. You fucked up, so fuck you too. But I am going to check out that movie, and I encourage y'all to check out that movie. So you see I'm warmed up. Because it's time. It's time. Hold on, let me get my bottle. Time for my weekly rant. So, my weekly rant is aimed at two people today. Conor McGregor and Gary Owens. Gary Owens and his wife and Conor McGregor. So I'm going to go in on Conor first, because I'm going to unleash on Gary. Because Gary Owens the guy too motherfucking comfortable. And we got to let these folk know what happened when they get too motherfucking comfortable. We don't play that shit. You done got too comfortable. And we finna rein this shit back in. We finna reel this back in. Because this level of comfort that you have with black people, Gary Owens, oh, hell no. Nah. A brother like me who read between the lines, nah, I'm too studied to let that shit happen. But let's start off with Conor McGregor, old dumb. Conor McGregor is a thug. And I say that because Conor McGregor keep doing, like, what he just did was thuggish shit. What he did was thuggish stuff. This is what street people do. Now, if you don't know, Let me read this article. Let me read this information, and then I'm going to go in on Conor. But Conor, and the reason why, hey, if you smoke a crack rock, you're a crack. You're a crackhead, right? If you steal, you're a thief. So if you do thuggy stuff, you're a thug. So don't be mad at me for calling Conor a thug. You should have told him not to do it. But Conor McGregor stole the show during UFC 223 Saturday night at the Barclays Center in Brooklyn, and he wasn't even fighting, at least not in the octagon. On Saturday, as UFC president Dana White promised, McGregor's reign as the sports lightweight king was over when Khabib, long last name, B.L., other last name I can't, La Quinta. Is that like La Quinta in? Okay, so Khabib Nurmagomedov. So Khabib Nurmagomedov, B.L. La Quinta. That left White making sense of a wild few days in UFC. You can imagine he's going to be sued beyond belief, White said, of McGregor's rampage. This was a real bad career move for him right now. No, I mean, do you want to be in business with Conor McGregor right now? Do you want to chase? Do you want to chase this guy around for interviews and buy his fights through you? Still, White planned to consider his options, and after Nurmagomedov's win, his father, who was his coach, was game for a bout with McGregor. He's been stripped of the belt now, but if the UFC gives him the right to become a contender, why not? So, Abdulmanap Nurmagomedov said, it's better if he fights Khabib than fights a bust. Ah, right. So the Irishman turned himself into police custody Thursday, and this is past Thursday, and was charged with 3 counts of assault and 1 count of criminal mischief as his role in a fracas that left UFC fighter Michael Chelsea in the hospital with a facial laceration he suffered when McGregor broke windows of a bus carrying fighters. The incident took place after a media event ahead of UFC 223. McGregor appeared in handcuffs Friday afternoon in a packed Brooklyn courtroom. But let me go back. So, well, hold on. Let me read. So McGregor appeared in handcuffs Friday night in a packed Brooklyn courtroom where the judge set bail at $50,000 and set a court date of June 14th. The judge also said McGregor would be allowed to leave the country, according to reports. He said he would? Wow. Per ESPN, he was released after a brief arrangement in order to stay away from the fighters Michael Chelsea and Ray Borg, among others, including via social media. The rampage apparently was directed at a rival fighter who was leaving the Barclays Center. MMA Fight Report reported that Kane Cowley, McGregor's SBG teammate, who was charged with 1 count of assault, he was charged with one count of assault and one count of criminal mischief over the incident. Cowley's bail was set at $2,500. According to veteran MMA reporter Ariel Helwani, who called this week without question the craziest 5 days in UFC history, McGregor, perhaps the most famous name in the sport, was led out of the 78th precinct in Brooklyn and was taken to a car Friday morning before the court appearance. He showed no emotion in the courtroom. So, basically, from what I was told, from the information I gathered, McGregor was mad at UFC and everything that was going on because they took the belt from him when he went to go fight Floyd. He had the belt. He went to go fight Floyd. They was like, we can't hold up our champion for you. So they took the belt from him, and you got other people fighting for the belt. And McGregor was mad that he wasn't fighting for the belt. So he flew this dumbass, this fuckboy, this crack-ass cracker got on the plane, flew 7 hours to come over to Brooklyn and do that dumb shit. So basically they threw guardrails. They threw a dolly through a window of a bus, and the window cracked, broke, glass flew everywhere, glasses in people's eyes, cutting people's faces. They say eyes were cut, face were cut, somebody's knuckles got broke, people got beat up, people were upset, mad, shaking, all these things. And the thing that Dana White kept stressing is, the players were in a state to where they not in the best position to defend themselves because they're trying to make weight. So they're very, very dehydrated because the first thought people would say, well, they fight, why they didn't just fight back? First of all, they were sneak attacked, and then they're very, very, very dehydrated, right? Try fighting when you're dehydrated and you're getting sneak attacked, right? So they basically said McGregor had, it was 20 other little crazy-ass white boys with McGregor on some thug shit who went and tried to do this. And I would kick McGregor's ass out of the sport for that. That's me. That's what I would do. Either that or we got to beat his ass. But it's like, what I didn't appreciate is somebody like us. Well, you know how I feel about Skip Bayless. Skip Bayless is a simp. But Skip trying to play down and make light of this and saying, well, this is a PR move. And it may have been a PR move, but it's criminal. It's a criminal act. It's a criminal act. You cannot do that. You can't do this stuff. Now, if McGregor was black, oh, man, they would have ran him through the mud. If McGregor was black, the world of sports would be going crazy right now if McGregor was black and had done that. Think about it. Think about the level of hell nah that would be happening if McGregor was a black person who committed those criminal acts. He literally assaulted him and his 20 homeboys, his 20 fuckboys, assaulted people. That's not okay. But this is what white privilege can't afford you, though. White privilege also allows you to do that and be able to leave the country. I got a homeboy who can't leave the country because of child support. He beating up people, throwing dollies at people, and they let him leave the country. Conor McGregor, you was a bitch for that. This is a straight bitch move, Conor. If you're in a sport, and if you got an issue with somebody or you want to fight somebody real bad, set it up. But for you to take these actions that you are taking, McGregor, you ain't shit. You ain't shit, Conor McGregor. And you are the thug that they say you are, because even going back to the Floyd Mayweather fight and everything, like the way, the racial tones and things that you were using. But first of all, McGregor is a fake-ass Floyd Mayweather. Let's just put that out there. McGregor wants to be Mayweather so bad. Because you know how white boys are. White boys are unoriginal. So since they're the only thing they are original at is being thieves. But as far as creating culture, creating cool, creating, they're unoriginal. So they see what we do, take it, and then just make it white. But everything Conor McGregor is doing as far as the promotion aspect of himself, he stole that from Floyd Mayweather, right? He wants to be Floyd. Now, how does this affect Conor McGregor going into the Floyd Mayweather? And that's another thing that pissed me off about. I'm going to come back to that. How does this affect Conor McGregor going to the Floyd Mayweather situation with a potential MMA fight to have between Conor and Floyd? But Skip Bayless also trying to make it seem as if this, you know, bringing up, all of this is happening. Well, Floyd Mayweather, I'm going to have to put Skip in another weekly rant. I don't like that white boy. Skip Bayless is, he talks a good game when it comes to that racial stuff, but Skip Bayless is a first-class hater, and don't trust his ass. Don't trust him. Straight fuck boy. But Conor McGregor is an even bigger fuck boy. He'll push a hole for this one. Matter of fact, I got to talk to you how we talk to real bitch ass women. I don't call them that. I don't call women bitches and hoes, but other women who encounter other bitch ass women that I consider bitch ass women, they call them pussy hoes. So Conor McGregor, you a pussy hoe for this? Straight pussy hoe for this? It's some real cracker ass cracker stuff that you just did. Or I'm mad. So since I'm, that's my little garbage, and I'm trying to have a garbage ass Irish accent. Since I'm mad, I'm going to jump on my airplane and fly to me New York and try to fight. Fuck you, Connor. That was stupid. You are an idiot. And then once another thing Skip Bayless tried to make the excuse of, well, this is all he knows. First of all, Conor McGregor is not the very first or the last person to grow up in a tough environment where they had to do a lot of fighting. I just saw an interview with Holloman, I think his name is. He's an MMA fighter, black MMA fighter, who was talking about how he grew up in Ferguson, Missouri, and had to fight. Like, he's not the first person to ever have to fight, not the first person to grow up in gangs, around gang fighting, all these things. And this Skip Bayless trying to make those excuses for Conor McGregor's behavior. That's not acceptable, because if Conor McGregor was a black person, you would tell him he needed to get new friends. If Conor McGregor was a black person, you would tell him, well, this is new stuff. You got to act differently. You're in a different environment. But white boys, like, me and my homeboy was having a conversation about this earlier. White men are not expected to mature. White men are not expected to mature. White men are only expected to continue the system of white supremacy and racism. They're not expected to mature. And we were having this conversation because we're talking about how Donald Trump, how people have come out and said Donald Trump is the same exact person that he was in the first grade, which is a complete waste of time. So white men, it seems as if white men are not expected to mature or carry themselves at a level that the rest of the races and people are. Like, white men can just do anything. Like, I'm in the state of Florida, and I think they say they have 66,000 white racist hate groups here in the state of Florida. 66,000 in the state of Florida. So it seems as if white men are not expected to grow up. Hence Conor McGregor's behavior, and hence another white man. See, that's why platforms like this need to exist, because you have a white man fucking up, and then you got another white man who's trying to justify his fucking up, and then try to demonize Floyd Mayweather all in the same case.
You might not. I'm not asking you to like Floyd Mayweather, but this ain't got nothing to do with Floyd. Conor McGregor acting stupid ain't got nothing to do with Floyd, even though people want the Floyd Mayweather-Conor McGregor fight because they're saying, well, Floyd Mayweather's starting to train and all that. I don't give a damn about none of that. Conor McGregor, his ass needs to go to jail, and he needs to be in jail for some years. I don't want to, even though we know he probably ain't going to, I don't want to see that. If I was one of them fighters, I'm pressing four charges. We finna break this. All that money you made for Floyd, all that money you made from that Floyd fight, we finna dig all up in your cracker-ass pockets. You finna dig all up in your stanking ass, cracker ass pockets. That's what I would do. That's what I would do. Straight up. I'm breaking your cracker ass down for being stupid. Straight up. And Conor McGregor is a proponent of the white supremacy system. We learned that with the Floyd Mayweather fight. So don't come at me, well, why he talking about, man, fuck Conor McGregor. Is a proponent of the white supremacy, right? So I mean, you know, that's just where it is. Like me personally, like I don't give no fucks, no shorts, no losses on white supremacy. Like if you're a proponent of white supremacy, man, what you want me to do? How am I supposed to act? I'm supposed to be just, well, you know, he is a fighter, man. Fuck that fighting shit. Fuck that. What Conor McGregor crossed the line. What he did. It's past the athletic realm. You're now in the real life realm, and you just threatened my life. You just put my life. That's how I would. If I was one of the fighters, that's how I would be. You just put my life in harm's way, and we got to fuck you up. We got to get you. We got to get you. We finna dig straight up in them pockets. Why fight him? Take all that money. Take all that money he just gained from that Floyd Mayweather fight, because he probably going to get sued by the Barclays. If I'm UFC, I would sue him. All them fighters I would sue. Security getting sued. I mean, security, they say, could sue him. So many people are on the plate and on the mantle to sue Conor McGregor. Sue his bitch ass. Sue him and make that cracker regret the fact that he ever came to America. Fuck you, Conor McGregor. So I'm not going to waste all my juices on bitch-ass Conor McGregor because it's time to go in on Gary Owens. And I know this ain't got nothing to do with sports, but fuck it. This is my weekly rant, and I get a chance to go off on people in my weekly rant. So Gary Owens, you and your wife are a part of my weekly rant. So Gary Owens want to go around calling. Gary Owens wants to call black people niggas. That's what we just learned about Gary Owens. Cracker comedian Gary Owens wants to call black people niggas. Any white people who want to call you a nigga is a proponent of white supremacy. I'm going to say that again. Any white person who wants to call you a nigga, white people, I have a question. What is your desire in calling someone a nigga? That shows you the lack of maturity that these white guys have, that these white people who have a desire to call you a nigga because they think that makes them down. They think that makes them cool. White America, black people, we call each other niggas because of social conditioning, because we have been socially engineered to be niggas. We've been socially engineered to be niggas. And essentially, a nigger is a black form of the worst white person. Because remember, nigger culture is just it's just white culture that was given to black people. So essentially, a nigger, like the behavior and the negative stuff that comes with the nigger, and I know somebody probably going to come on and talk about the Negus and the Goss and the Niger. I ain't talking about that type of nigger. I'm talking about white. I'm talking about the nigger that was when he got here. The mentality, the way of life, the way of existing as a nigger, right? That there is inherently white. But understanding the oppression and the pain that comes with that word, when a white person wants to call you a nigga, it's time to bust them in their face. So this all started with comedian Gary Owens went on The Breakfast Club last week before last, and he was imitating the
one of these new dumbass rappers, Tekashi 6ix9ine, 69, whatever he calls himself, 69 boy, whatever his name is, right? So, imitating Tekashi 6ix9ine, 69 boys, whatever his name is, he was taking shots at everybody. And me personally, I wouldn't have, at that juncture, I wouldn't have taken it serious. I would have laughed because I thought it was hilarious. Now, the comedian Michael Blackson, I'm sure it was still in a realm of comedic stuff, right? But being the person who played a dozen, Michael Blackson shot back, and he called them all type of beach-ass niggas. And everybody know, you know, Michael Blackson always calling people beach-ass niggas and motherfuckers and stuff like that. So, you know, so they had that back and forth. So Gary Owens, apparently, the last thing I saw from Gary Owens in this back and forth with him, Michael Blackson, he was sitting in his house, and Gary Owens is married to a black woman. Right. So he was like, I want to call. Basically, he was like, I want to call you a nigga, but I can't call you a nigga because I'm white, but my wife can call you a nigga. So he's like, hey, basically, Gary Owens got his wife to call Michael Blackson a nigga because he can't call Michael Blackson a nigga. So not only are you man enough to say it, are you not man enough to say it for yourself, you went and dragged your black wife, who's a dumbass, by the way, my auntie need to beat her ass. Because when Gary Owens presented this idea to him, she should have slapped the fuck out of Gary Owens when he presented this idea to her. Hey, baby, I'm a whole lot of little bitch-ass dog. I'm a little Morky-type dog, little bitch-ass Maltese Morky-type dog. I'm a whole little bitch-ass dog in my arms, and I'm going to try to act hard. And I'm going to say these certain things back to Michael Blackson, you know, shooting the dozens, but when it comes to the N-word, I want you to say nigga. And she was all in it. Nigga, you bitch nigga, you fuck nigga, nigga, nigga. She was all into it, like all into it. And she relished upon the opportunity to stand up for her cracker-ass husband and call another black person a nigga. She should have slapped Gary Owens in his motherfucking mouth when he told her the idea. Gary Owens, that is straight unacceptable. I'm not a comedian, but I know that crossed comedic lines. That has crossed comedic lines. And Gary Owens, you should have your ass whooped for that. I don't play that shit. That's not funny, right? Because I don't see the friendliness or the brotherhood or any whatever. I don't see the need for a white person to want to call a black person a nigga. Like, what do you get off on that other than you are continuing the legacy of white supremacy and racism? Like, other than that, what the fuck you getting out of that, Gary Owens? But see, you the little goof-ass, bitch-ass cracker boy that need to be slapped the fuck out of. And if you get slapped in your mouth, I'm not going to be mad. Because I don't take kindly to that shit, though. Because Gary Owens, you've gotten too comfortable with black people because you're always trying to act like you're on our side. Now, I ain't say nothing when you jumped in the middle of the Monique Will Packer thing. I ain't say nothing. But as it was pointed out, we should have known then, oh, man, this white boy done got comfortable. This white boy done got comfortable. For Gary Owens, you done got real comfortable. You done got real, and your dumbass wife done got real comfortable. Y'all behavior is unacceptable. You a crack ass cracker for that. Hey, and I don't call black women out of their name. I don't call black women B's and H's and stuff like that. But your wife is stupid as shit. Your wife is stupid as shit for participating in that dumbass shit right there. She's stupid as shit. And you can get mad at me for saying you brought her with the idea. And you a bitch ass, crack ass cracker, fuck boy ass cracker for wanting, you want to call us niggas. Now we see where you at now, Gary Owens. You want to call us niggas. That shit is unacceptable. right? And then and don't try to act like you our friend. Don't try to act like you down with black people, down with the black cause, but then behind closed doors you want to call black people niggas. Like, how that work? Like, how we get there? How are you for black people, but at the same time you want to call us niggas? So that's how it is. When you get mad, we niggas, right? When your back is in the corner, we niggas. But other than that, oh, I'm down with black people, skibbity hoo ha. Fuck you, Gary Owens. We see where you at. You and Michael Rappaport, y'all two crackers. Y'all done got too comfortable. Y'all done got way too goddamn comfortable. Remember, black people, remember, they like the culture, not the people. They like the culture, not the people. Ain't no William O'Neill in me. Ain't no William O'Neill in me. Ain't no sellout in me. I peep the bullshit. Gary Owens, you's a fuck boy. And you need your ass whooped for this one. You need your ass, and I say you need your ass whooped for this one, because you should know better. You're supposed to know better. You've been around black people too long. And see, but I also blame black people. This is our fault for being too goddamn friendly with other motherfuckers. Like, read some history, black people. Read some history and stop being especially friendly with the Ekwensuoja. And if you don't know what Ekwensuoja mean, that's because you ain't see Ace Ventura, Pet Detective. When Nature Calls, right? Or Ace Ventura, When Nature Calls. That's the second one, when Ace Ventura went to the African village and they called him Ekwensuoja. Ekwensuoja, which means white devil. So Gary Owens is Ekwensuoja. And also, in watching that, fuck that movie, too. Fuck Ace Ventura, When Nature's Called. I couldn't even watch 5 minutes of that movie. Now that I'm enlightened, I've taken the blue pill, I'm enlightened. My mind is wide open. I'm like, just like what James Baldwin said. When you become conscious of what's going on around you, you're always mad. Because you see the fuck shit that's always going on. And yeah, people are like, well, you too conscious. You too awake. What the fuck does it mean to be too conscious and too awake? Oh, but we're not too conscious and too awake when shit like this, when fuck shit happened, when racial stuff happened that's too uncomfortable for you, because a lot of y'all are comfortable with being oppressed. A lot of y'all are comfortable with racism, but not this Gary Owens shit. Fuck Gary Owens. No, not on my watch. Not that I got this show and this platform and I get to speak my piece. Fuck no, Gary Owens. Fuck no. You's a bitch, and you have lost my support, and I would encourage all black people to stop supporting Gary Owens, because he want to call us some niggas. Fuck you, Gary Owens. You's a bitch, and your wife's stupid as shit. And that's all I got to say about that. Hey, man, I'm Joseph Ward. This is the Fix Sports Podcast. Remember, we're right here on the Freedom Train Network. Learn more about us at www.freedomtrainradio.com. Remember, our weekly lineup every Monday. You get my show, this here right here, the Fix Sports Podcast. Every Wednesday, you get the Freedom Train Podcast series, as well as the live showing of Office Hours with Professor Carl Tone Jones and Erica Tolbert. Every Thursday, you get Office Hours with, every Thursday, you get Lessons from the Screen, brought to you by Patrick Urban. And one time, thank you, Pat, for coming on and breaking down boxing and Wilder versus Joshua and all the other aspects of boxing that we were talking about. So that's every Thursday, you get Lessons from the Screen with Patrick Urban. Every Friday, you get the Office Hours with Professor Carl Tone Jones and Erica Tolbert podcast, which was available on iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. Every Saturday, you get the Tea Time Black Women Talk Show. And you also get the On the Shoulders of Giants podcast, which is African history, which is profiled biographies of the sung and unsung heroes of the African diaspora. And you get that every Saturday via iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, or on the Freedom Train website. Remember, all of our shows are available on the Freedom Train website, www.freedomtrainradio.com. as well as iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, and more platforms are coming up. Hey, man, I love being black. I love black people. I'm passionate about being black, and I have short patience for people who are proponents of white supremacy. That's where my passion comes from. So, hey, man, until next time, y'all keep it real, y'all keep it live, and don't let nobody tell you what you can't do in life, because you black. and you have the capacity to do anything you want to do in life, and the force of God is flowing within you. So with that, two fingers up, split them apart.
Peace. I am the greatest.
I called the president. President, we need the National Guard. We need as many men as you can spare, because we are killing the Patriots. So call the dogs off. Send the National Guard, please. They need emergency help.
That ball hit hard. Stretch. Austin Jackson back looks up. You can put it on the board. Yes. Back to back, Jack. And it is 4-1.
On that ball. Jackson has it. The All-American tight end is going in. And Oklahoma takes the lead on a 71-yard touchdown play.
I was going to rip his heart out. I'm the best ever. I'm the most brutal and vicious and most ruthless champion there's ever been. There's no one can stop me. Lex is a conqueror. No, I'm Alexander. He's no Alexander. I'm the best ever. There's never been anybody ruthless. I'm Sonny Liston. I'm Jack Dempsey. There's no one like